personalities, Miles, Mingus, and Monk.
Because they would pick on him, and he would take it. He would never fight back.
Uh-huh.
He would never say, you motherfucker, man, I'm going to kick your ass. He would never do that to any point where they would take him seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, his job was to take that kind of abuse. I mean, I work with Cassandra Wilson. I know what that kind of crap is about.
Uh-huh.
And certain personalities will take that kind of heat, and then it'll all explode. And that's what happened. That's what happened to him.
Yeah.
So much of that antagonism that he has built up in him from having to have those battles with the musicians.
Right.
Artists. And now he's like, you know, it's my turn. You know, I'm going to establish my reputation. Nobody's buying it.
Yeah, yeah. Are you going to get a chance to work on those Jack Johnson sessions?
Well, yeah, we went in and proposed yesterday just to finish up all the Miles stuff and just let us loose in the studios putting it all together.
Uh-huh.
Which I don't mind at all.
What would you ideally do with the Jack Johnson? How would you put that
in? Well, our first plan, we've actually had a discussion, would be to, you know, one way or the other, either start the record with Jack Johnson, the album, with all the edits and everything, and then do session reels, or do sessions and then end the set with a remastered Jack Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem is you don't want to take away from people the end result of all the edits and the organization. And at the same time, you know, you want to be able to show where it all came from.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and that's our last real cut-and-paste box.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because then we'll have Coltrane to do, and then the 63-64 period, and then we're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that'll be a good time, too, and then maybe you can start with some, you know, one of the things that's happened is Miles, I guess, sells so well that some things haven't been gotten to. For instance, I was really glad to see Sony reissue Blood Ulmer's Odyssey, a record I like a lot.
We had a meeting yesterday. In the meeting, the subject came up of it has sold 1,600 copies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I chimed in, which would be a big seller at Blue Note.
Right.
See, they're used to selling in reissue.
Or in Evidence or something.
75,000 to 150,000 copies. I mean, kind of blue. Over 400,000. Probably go gold this year. Again.
And it sold 1,600.
Well, no.
Odyssey did.
Oh, yeah. And that's big.
Yeah.
No. I'm encouraged by that.
Yeah.
There are 1,600 insane people out there buying records.
Yeah.
But Sketches of Spain, 150,000. Porgy and Bess, 150,000. Headhunter. 100,000.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shocking to see what these things, and it's because they have such great distribution. They get it everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere, you know.
Well, these things become the enemy of the smaller things in the catalog. It works that way with publishers too. If you get
we have an advantage in that the way Legacy is run, that we can put in and get out obscure, really not, big selling records, based on their trust in us as producers to come up with things that either the public needs or needs to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to get them to do Compost.
Mm-hmm.
You know that group?
Yeah.
And that's pretty obscure.
Yeah.
But hey, the timing is right.
Well, how does stuff like the gospel stuff, like Marion Williams, even a fairly well known gospel singer, do?
Well, that's another person. It's kind of
right.
A real fact.
Yeah.
And it depends on if they market it correctly. I mean, they have a marketing company. Harmony is their gospel division. And they service radios. And if they service the radios with reissues, they'll sell well.
Because, oh, yeah.
Reissues are pretty hot.
Did you hear that Emmett Miller one that was done?
No. I stay away from the gospel side.
Well, this is the last of the Blackface Minstrels, the guy that sounds like Hank Williams copped every one of his licks. Emmett Miller, the...
Yeah, that's generally done by Leo Sachs and some of those guys.
Yeah.
But my thing, this is weird. Remember that commercial where they said, give it to Mikey, he'll like anything?
Right.
Well, I'm the guy that got to do Fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody did Fusion. So I figured everybody's fighting over the legendary stuff. I'm going to say, I'll do all the Fusion. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So boom, I get all the Fusion, which is Electric Miles, Weather Report, Herbie, and that whole morass of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And man, there's hundreds of records there to work on.
Yeah.
And there's no pressure because generally it's a different kind of audience. get into the legendary, the real, the roots of the music, man, they've got some experts up there that I don't even want to get next to. They're so good at what they do.
Did you do, because I never got a copy of it, or may not have come out yet, Don Ellis's Electric Bath?
Yes.
I love that record.
Yeah, it's they asked me they wanted me to come up with important fusion titles. I said, well, here was the first guy who came out with a jazz record that had the word electric in it.
Yeah. I think that's a really fine record.
And there's some cuts on it that are very much, ahead of their time.
Has that kind of swirling George Russell sort of sound.
Yeah, with an ego of Don Ellis.
Yeah, right.
But we're also doing the Monterey concert of Don Ellis.
Uh-huh.
And it's fun because I was able to work on both of them and coordinate kind of the vision.
Yeah.
And, my thing is also big bands from the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And anything I can do to get those things out, we do.
Well, he had some of those people do the best work they ever did. I mean, I don't know that I've ever heard Tom Scott play like he did with...
Well, when was the last Ira Shulman solo that knocked you out?
Right.
And the other thing that Legacy has done that, I mean, it's not going to be exciting to a writer, but what they've done is they've gotten more musicians and people involved in the project in the original sense to comment and make comments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
In essence, we're not going to opinion as much as, I was there and this is what I thought.
Right.
It's an opinion a little closer to reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's helped out a little bit. It's made it more exciting sometimes to buy these.
Yeah, I like that. I like that in those Miles Davis reissues, especially the live ones that came out last year. I thought that was well done on that. I get a little weary of Orrin Keaton News. I was there. I know. Yet again.
But again, when Chick Corea says, it's not about the music. It's the essence. Then you realize.
Right. Yeah. Well, what do you know about the? This is off the subject, but what do you know about the Baroness? Anybody write anything on her? Does she show up in any of the Baroness Nika?
Is she still alive?
No, she's dead. I know that. I'm saying that,
essentially the only thing that goes down is when an heir to the estate or an ex-sideman looking for bread or a former producer gets hot and bothered. That's all we really hear from.
Mm-hmm.
Other than musicians going, that alternate take is amazing. Or the New York Times trying to really... The New York Times has been on our case. About our stylistic choices.
Yeah.
And, we had to have a little meeting up at Sony to say, protect us from this idiot.
Right.
So now, we've got Berkowitz answering questions.
Yeah. Well, one thing I really did like, let's say on that last Monk, the double Monk, when Keep News did decide to take all the alternates and put them on the second disc toward the end, that idea that people might have a changer if they want to A, B the things, they can do it that way, but this way you don't have to plow through, the way he would do things over at Fantasy, the way you don't have to plow through false starts, alternates.
The concept, it depends on the artist. If you're doing like a solo Monk, right?
Yeah.
You can't really do two solo versions of, Bright, whatever it is that he's doing at the time, because that's a very intimate setting, and you lose the emotion and the visceral sense of that performance if you do the alternate take and then a false start and then the master, right?
Uh-huh.
But with Miles, because every time they did a take, that was intended to be the take. He was not a let's just warm up for one and then see what happens on the next one.
Yeah.
So every time there's a false, every time there's an alternate take, that just means, well, this is going to be the take, but Tony said, let's do it again, or Miles said, let's do it again.
Uh-huh.
And to me, they're just separate performances.
Mm-hmm.
In one way, you can't really tag them at the end, because if you hear a flow, I hear a musical energy flow and a conceptual flow between some of those takes. Like what they would play on this one, which would not be heard on the other one.
Yeah.
So, from a standpoint, it's really done for the hardcore music fan.
Right.
And the consumer has a right to complain about it, but we don't listen to consumers.
Yeah, good.
And I listened to the bass player who was on the session.
Yeah, yeah. I made the mistake of telling Tio that I really liked Panther. Thalassa.
Oh, God. That's, I should have warned you about that.
That was like saying sick 'em.
Yeah.
That was great, though. I, you know.
Did you get him on tape?
Yeah, I got it.
Very few people have ever got him on tape ranting, you know?
Yeah.
Because I figured, hey, that's going to be a sample on a record, you know?
It wasn't. It's not a great tape. It's too bad. I'd have to play around with that tape. You ever going to write a book? You should.
About Miles Davis?
About what you're doing. Miles Davis yourself. I mean, getting
in. No, I mean, I'm actually involved. In, I have a book. So I actually have two little things that I've been writing over the last year.
Have you?
Yeah. I really enjoy writing, you know.
Well, I'm editing a series of books for Temple University Press. If you're interested in a university press.
Well, my book is about a rape of a girl.
Oh, okay. So it's a novel.
Yeah. Well, it's a novel that's ultimately going to end up on somebody's desk in Hollywood.
Uh-huh.
I know too many people.
You doing anything on music?
I have to do an article on Miles in the Oxford Companion.
Oh, okay.
But,
You work with Scott DeVoe on that?
Oh, that's actually through Kirshner.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know. I mean, you know, I would rather write a novel than write a informational text, because informational texts get very dated, unless you're writing the definitive version.
Yeah.
And the music, as you know, it's so hard to update.
Well, I guess. I mean, you could write
Miles
something.
Miles Davis now is irrelevant because of all the material they weren't able to peruse and to make their arguments, you know, either, you know, go in this direction or that direction.
Well, I need to pick your brain again sometime, but I'd like to write I'd like to write something on the shift in the aesthetics of production.
That's a great book because you have so many people who have different ways of looking at it, you know.
Yeah.
And nowadays, in the modern time, when the producer has as much play in the business as the artist.
Right.
That aesthetic. I mean, Craig Street, you guys could talk for 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's a very pronounced producer guy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it'd be interesting, because in jazz, it's totally different than rock and roll.
You think in jazz it's changed, or you think it's pretty much the way it was with T.O. or Keith News?
It's changed
dramatically.
First of all, there's a lot more musicians who are producing their own records, and also a lot more musicians becoming producers, producing other people's records. Because it's got a little thing in downbeat now, it's a sought-after job. I mean, a cat's come up to me, and how do I get in there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, at this case point, the only time only way you're going to get in there is to marry Jeff Jones' two-year-old daughter, and that's not going to happen for a while. But for the most part, it is. It's an interesting subject. I don't know who would be outside of other producers and musicians.
Yeah.
Who would really want to? But it can have a dramatic effect on what an artist does. I mean, just in jazz, Cassandra's first two records.
Oh, I know it.
That in itself is, you know, is a symbol of, you know, kind of the power of production.
Boy, it really is, yeah.
You know, and in certain people's records, they're distinguished by their lack of production.
Yeah. But when you think about the number of books that are out there on the aesthetics of film directing, and on particular film directors, and you think about what the equivalent is with music, it's pretty shocking, the disparity.
And as a result, I mean, you can see that the musicians in themselves, their lack of that kind of scope makes a lot of what they do small time. I mean, my next project for Blue Note is going to be based on the Black Dahlia.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about that murder in Los Angeles?
I try and remember. I don't know it.
You
know, it's way back there.
Cut in half, drained of blood in an empty lot in L.A.
Uh-huh.
But it created this kind of like mythological Jack the Ripper environment, which, you know, if you combine the mid to late 40s sound of jazz in L.A., you really get a nice visual and oral thing.
Yeah.
Plus, you can tell a story.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't tell a story. I mean, that's why Ellington did his suites, because he could tell a story, you know, with those suites.
Yeah.
He could actually give people to follow his music.
They've just reissued the, and cleaned up, changed, you know, the Bernard Herrmann's, all the cues to Taxi Driver.
Oh, wow.
That's a really nice recording.
The Psycho record that Esa-Pekka Salonen did. You heard that one?
I've heard that collection of the Hitchcock
Well, this is just from Psycho itself.
Oh, I haven't heard the Psycho one. The one I heard was all the Herman Hitchcock things.
The Psycho is good because you can put it on in the background, right, and call up somebody and go, hi. You know, and it's going, in the background, you know.
Yeah.
You can definitely wake somebody up.
Yeah, they're on the... Salona and I heard there's also the Vertigo theme and then the love theme from Vertigo, which I like a lot. And then there's
film. As you know, film is really the art form of the latter 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is the medium of the century, if you really want to know the truth. And I talk to musicians all the time about how they have no visual identity. Their music has no visual identity, and they lose a big portion of their potential audience.
Yeah.
Because it's just a, what would you call, like, a one-dimensional static experience, as opposed to, you know, I mean, if you listen to the sound, you know, the Psycho soundtrack, you don't need to see the movie.
I know it.
You know, you're right there in that shower.
Yeah.
And I think that's somewhat lacking in the jazz business.
Yeah.
And I myself, I'm all for narrative.
Right.
Well,
and then you even get it in Psycho with that Saul Bass lettering at the beginning and the way they edit the
opening credits.
Have you
seen the DVD of Psycho?
No, I haven't.
Great, man. They got the trailers, the promo stuff. They got scripts, you know, because they have a whole information rack.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out.
And no commercials.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll have to check that out, definitely.
I mean, one of my goals is to actually, you know, to not write music for a movie, which is... And jazz is always secondary to the ego of the director. But, I mean, like Jan Hammer, collaborate with video artists and try to put together very interesting things that cross between the audio and the visual.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want Sony to let me do some surround mixes for IMAX of classic fusion pieces.
Oh, that'd be great.
Like stuff from Sextant or Heavy Weather.
Yeah, yeah, that would be good. Well, the producer is called, as opposed to film directors, producers are routinely and historically called upon to be self-effacing. And I don't know exactly when that begins. I mean, there are these really important producers, let's say Ralph Peer, in country music, and he's also going to record the Benny Moten Orchestra. But they're, even though they're, in some ways, to fans, fairly famous, when they walk into the studio, they're self-effacing and they're invisible. Whereas directors, early on, impose their personality on the product.
Well, it's only if the artist is willing to either go along with the program or is too naive to understand the difference. In jazz, you have a couple of approaches. You know, if you're dealing with an artist, let's say Joe Lovano.
Mm-hmm.
So if you work with Joe, you can, if you're assigned to produce his record or co-produce or exec produce it, the first question you ask him is, what do you want to do? Or what is your vision for this next record, right?
Yep.
And if he has a definitive idea, hey, then your job is made much easier. Because all you do is just make sure that functionally what he's getting is what he gets.
Mm-hmm.
But if he says, I don't know, what do you think? Then you have an opportunity to work with somebody on a higher level.
Yeah.
I just did a Tim Higgins record for Blue Note, where we tried to, you know, I just finished Bitches Brew, his record was coming up. I've been sending him drum and bass and jungle stuff for most, like, 6 months.
Yeah.
And check out the flow, man. And explain to him how when pop music, when psychedelic rock, the ace note value, in other words, when Hendrix is playing dum-dum, or dun-dun-dun-dun, pop-pop-pop-pum-pum-pum, you know, when you could hear the dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun the pulse, that's when it locked up with Charlie Parker jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So psychedelic rock in the 80s, I mean in the 60s, their rhythmic pulse matched up with jazz. So Miles Davis could play his shit on top of the rock and roll stuff.
Yeah.
And then you got the funk and fusion and disco and boom. Now we're back to drum and bass where those eighth notes are hooking up again.
Yeah.
So I said to Higgins, let's go here, man, because nobody else is doing it, for one. And, let's see what we find out of it.
Yeah.
Man, oh man. It's like putting a film together.
Was that, you produced that for Blue Note?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I look forward to hearing that.
But see, most artists don't want you to get that involved in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They got their music, their arrangements, their guys, they're going to do their record. And then they complain that nobody finds it.
Yeah. Well, these electronica things that are coming out sound, man, they should make people interested in these Miles Davis recordings again.
Well, there's a... See, I have a feeling that you know, when the Miles Electric came out, we had a meeting at Columbia about it, and I said, you know, this is going to really jumpstart a lot of people imitating this music.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did it.
Yeah.
Henry Kaiser's record, Bobby Previtt, Pantalassa.
Uh-huh.
Pantalassa was originally going to be a Herbie record. It was originally going to be a Herbie remix, and we couldn't find the multi-track.
Hmm.
So then Columbia said, well, why don't you do Miles?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, the drum and bass, the whole dance. I mean, did you hear about the Love Parade?
No.
You know, people were talking about, let's see, what was it in the States? A million people were gathered in Times Square or some shit recently, or somewhere, right? Remember, but the Love Parade was a million people dancing to techno in the streets of Berlin.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah.
And we tried to go there. I was over in Germany, and you know, we got about an hour and a half out of the city, and it was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking at it, that's our audience. I mean, if you're going to get into people who don't listen, let's go with these guys.
I know it.
Yeah. At least the chicks don't have any dresses on. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, that jazz just can't reach over to all those little pockets that might, you know, go for the music.
Are you hearing electronic stuff that knocks you out?
Yeah, yeah. Ronnie Size had a great record.
I liked it.
You know, because, I mean, what you hear on those is bass and drums.
Yep.
What you don't hear is the jazz on top, and what Hagen did, we did on that, we put the jazz stuff on top. You know?
I'm looking forward to this DJ Shadow thing that's coming out on Mowax called Uncle. And there's also a band called Asian Dub Foundation that sounds like they're going to do real good stuff in the next month.
Well, there was a group called the Finnish Ambient Techno Chant, and it was just a bunch of guys with no sunlight doing semi-fusion kind of records with dance and ambient beats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, hey, you can go this way.
Yeah.
You know, what it surprised me was when Roni Size came out, it sold almost 30,000 copies of a double record in about 2 months.
Yeah.
That if a jazz guy had done that, he'd be a genius.
Right, right.
And, you know, so I said, if we, you know, so my big manipulation now is to get him to put the Higgins record in the right bin.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. And, yeah, I wonder on the size how much of a effect winning that Mercury Prize has in the States.
Exactly, man.
Yeah, I know.
See, a guy like DJ Shadow automatically will get in there because his name and the way that the company's going to focus on his releases. But when jazz guys start tripping down the road, what are the jazz buyers going to do, you know?
Yeah.
Well, it's not Harry Connick, so we don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And that's our problem. I mean, it's not that it's jazz, but within jazz, there's a contingent that doesn't want progressive music.
Right. Yeah.
And they're violently anti-progressive music.
Yeah.
If you ever talk to the Sons of Marsalis, man, Jesus.
I know it.
Yeah, you know, my question is always to them, you know, how are you going to feel 10 years from now, realizing that you never, you know, that you were stupid? Because a guy says, how do you deal with the Lincoln Center stuff? I said, I don't. I just know I'll never hire any of the guys who work for him.
Right. Yeah.
It's out of meanness.
Yeah. And where I sit, who cares, you know?
Well, it does have a big effect on a lot of your business.
It has a big effect on it. It has a ripple effect all over the country, sure.
Well, I just want to know, man, why with all these guys in the city who are very talented at writing music for orchestra, jazz orchestra, would you pay your alto player to learn on the job? I mean, that's why they have college.
Yeah.
And that's what most people resent about it. Wynton is such a megalomania, such paranoid,
mm-hmm.
that he will not allow any real good professional to work on any of the projects.
Yeah. What's amazing to me is... the way you look at some of the concerts that Rob Gibson produced when he was running things in Atlanta.
Totally opposite of what he's doing up here.
I know. And I figure Stanley Crouch must have gotten to him in, like, the Manchurian Candidate. They just...
Oh, yeah, man. You know, there's a movie right there, you know.
they just brainwashed.
Hey, talk about that Lincoln Center is coming up with some marketing devices, like they're going to come up with a Wynton doll. Because they got a great deal on the Urkel doll when it went out of circulation. So they just put a big, different suit on the Urkel doll and call it the Wynton. And when you wind it up, I mean, when you pull the string, it says, and now I'm going to do a piece based on my experience in Metairie, Louisiana. then I found out that they're going to do a Rob Gibson doll. And they got a deal on a bunch of old Lassie cutouts. So whenever Winton's doll says, I'm going to do this, Rob Gibson's doll goes, woof, 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 woof. You know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, any other organization in America that did what they did would be in jail. The leaders would be in jail for what they tried to do, you know, to
yeah.
musicians under the guise of some ideology.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, I talked to Wallace Roney, right?
Uh-huh.
He got commissioned. I said, how many horns did they give him? He goes, 4 horns. I said, you're kidding. He said, well, the bread's not good. I said, but Wallace, I mean, you know, why would you just write for 4 horns? Because that's what you can do any day of the week, man. Why don't you challenge yourself
mm-hmm.
and tell them you want, like, a big band and string? You know?
Yeah.
Because it's not that way. Winton only gets those kind of commissions. And then, you know, it's interesting, though.
Yeah.
Just to see how much talent is wasted waiting around for something to happen for you.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm not hearing much.
Well, it's not an exciting program. I mean, you're going to hear more from these Weird Records people send you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You used to do the Weird Record column for Jazz, didn't
you? I did. Yeah. And, we got in a little fight at one point, and I quit writing for them, although I still talk to them sometimes.
Well, it's a horrible magazine, man, because you cannot read it.
I know. Just the print sometime, and then the writing of it. Well, the writing's better, actually. I think the last couple of issues have been more interesting.
Well, it's become more of a writer's magazine and not a jazz writer's magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Larry has kind of got this, who was the guy who ran the New Yorker, Carter something or other? Who was the famous 70s editor of the New Yorker?
Yeah, I don't know. I forgot his name. Yeah, that did that big jazz reader.
Pardon me?
Is it Gottlieb?
What, Bill Gottlieb?
I'm trying to remember who he got. I don't know. I'm digging for the name you're fishing for, but I can't find it. But yeah, I think Larry's made it a better magazine.
I'm saying, man, black ink, white print, man. Come on.
Right, right. No. Yeah.
When you want to read an article about a friend of yours and it's black ink on a red, blood red background.
Yeah, yeah.
Now even Downbeat's doing it.
I know.
And Jazz Times' trick is that they have the first paragraph of your article and then continued on page 203.
Right.
Up to you, hold on 1 second.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm writing, you know, this is for Tower Records magazine, Pulse. And it's
yeah, Pulse is a good magazine.
Yeah, I love my editors there.
They don't have a circulation problem to deal with.
They sure don't. They tested the waters of the magazine racks several years ago. But, yeah, I started writing for them after I wrote for Jazz Is, or actually while I was writing.
Creative artists all around the world should one day get together and kiss the ass of Tower Records.
Well, they do a good job keeping things in stock, yeah.
Because if it weren't for them, man, you know, it'd be very, very sad.
And I've never had an editor tell me, you know, you can't say this, you don't do this. I've got great editors there. There may be some, as there always is, some politics in the upper echelon, but I never hear about it.
Yeah, they don't want to know those kind of details.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for the most part, if you have a guy who's good at writing, you don't say anything to him.
Right. And they could, you know, the editors cover a lot of stuff in there that wouldn't ordinarily get covered. I mean, they take some chances, so I'm happy with them. I'm writing a little bit for Amazon.com, too. I'm writing a piece.
Yeah, the new online system.
Yeah, I'm writing a piece on Disco for them.
Oh, man. Well, sit back, because I think the jazz disco scene is about to, you know, come back in.
It probably is, yeah.
A lot of my... hold on just 1 second.
Okay.